Rubbing his muddy fingers together, Mr. Vess rises to his full height and slowly turns in a circle, studying the surrounding land, the meadows to the north and the distant piney woods beyond. The driveway leading east to the bald knoll, the yard to the south, more meadows beyond and woods again, finally the backyard past the barn to the foothills. The deer, if it was a deer, is gone. Etchler Vess stands motionless, listening, watchful, breathing deeply, seeking scents. Then for a while he inhales through his open mouth, catching what he can upon his tongue. He feels the moist air like the clammy skin of a cadaver against his face. All his senses are open wide, irised to the max, and the freshly washed world drains into them. Finally, he can detect no harm in the morning. As Vess is putting the license plate on the back of the motorhome, Tilsiter pads to him. The dog nuzzles his master's neck. Vess encourages the Doberman to stay. When he is finished with the plate, he points Tilsiter to the nearby deer spoor. The dog seems not to see the tracks, or seeing them, he does not have any interest. Vess leads him to the spoor, right in among the prints. Once more, he points to them. Because Tilsiter appears to be confused, Vess places his hand on the back of the dog's head and presses his muzzle into one of the tracks. The Doberman catches a scent at last, sniffs eagerly, whimpers with excitement, then decides that he doesn't like what he smells. He squirms out from under his master's hand and backs off, looking sheepish.
"What?" says Vess.
The dog licks his chops. He looks away from Vess, surveys the meadows, the lane, the yard. He glances at Vess again, but then he trots off to the south, returning to patrol. The trees still dripping, the mists rising, the spent clouds scudding fast toward the southeast. Mr. Vess decides to kill China Shepherd immediately. He will haul her into the yard, make her lie face down on the grass, and put a couple of bullets in the back of her skull. He has to go to work this evening, and before that he has to get some sleep, so he won't have time to enjoy a slow kill. Later, when he gets home, he can bury her in the meadow with the four dogs watching, insects singing and feeding on one another in the tall grass, an aerial force to kiss each of the corpses before it goes forever into the ground. All this in moonlight, if there is any. Quickly now, finish her and sleep. As he hurries toward the house, he realizes that the screwdriver is still in his hand, which might be more interesting than using the pistol, yet just as quick. Up the flagstone steps, onto the front porch, where the finger of the Seattle attorney hangs silent among the seashells in the cool, windless air. He doesn't bother to wipe his feet, a rare breach of compulsive procedure. The ratcheting hinge is matched by the sound of his own ragged breathing as he opens the door and steps into the house. When he closes the door, he is startled to hear his thudding heartbeats chasing one another. He is never afraid. Never. With this woman, however, he has been unsettled more than once. A few steps into the room, he halts, getting a grip on himself. Now that he is inside again, he doesn't understand why killing her had seemed to be such an urgent priority. Intuition. But never has his intuition delivered such a clamorous message that has left him this conflicted. The woman is special, and he so badly wants to use her in special ways. Merely pumping two shots into the back of her head or sticking the screwdriver into her a few times would be such a waste of her potential. He is never afraid. Never. Even being unsettled like this is a challenge to his dearest image of himself. The poet Sylvia Plath, whose work leaves Mr. Vess uncharacteristically ambivalent, once said that the world was ruled by panic. Panic with a dog face, devil face, hag face, whore face, panic in capital letters with no face at all, the same Johnny Panic, awake or asleep. But Johnny Panic does not rule Edgler Vess and never will, because Mr. Vess has no illusions about the nature of his existence, no doubts about his purpose, and no moments of his life that ever require reinterpretation when he has the time for quiet reflection. Sensation. Intensity. He cannot live with intensity if he is afraid, because Johnny Panic inhibits spontaneity and experimentation. Therefore, he will not allow this woman of mysteries to spook him. As both his breathing and his heartbeat subside to normal rates, he turns the rubberized handle of the screwdriver around and around in his hand, staring at the short, blunt blade at the end of the long, steel shank. The moment that Vess entered the kitchen before he spoke, China sensed that he had changed from the man that she had known thus far. He was in a different mood from any that had previously possessed him, although the precise difference was so subtle that she was not able to define it. He approached the table as if to sit down, then stopped short of his chair. Frowning and silent, he stared at her. In his right hand was a screwdriver. Ceaselessly he rolled the handle through his fingers, as if tightening an imaginary screw. On the floor behind him were crumbling chunks of mud. He had come inside with dirty shoes. She knew that she must not speak first. They were at a strange juncture where words might not mean what they had meant before, where the most innocent statement might be an incitement to violence. A short while ago, she had half preferred to be killed quickly, and she had tried to trigger one of his homicidal impulses. She had also considered ways that, although shackled, she might be able to commit suicide. Now she held her tongue to avoid inadvertently enraging him. Evidently, in her desolation, she continued to harbor a small but stubborn hope that was camouflaged in the grayness where she could not see it, a stupid denial, a pathetic longing for one more chance. Hope, which had always seemed ennobling to her, now seemed as dehumanizing as feverish greed, as squalid as lust, just an animal hunger for more life at any cost. She was in a deep, bleak place. Finally, Vess said,
"Last night."
She waited.
"In the redwoods."
"Yes."
"Did you see anything?"
he asked. "See what?"
"Anything odd?"
"No."
"You must have."
She shook her head.
"The elk,"
he said. "Oh, yes, the elk."
"A herd of them."
"Yes."
"You didn't think they were peculiar?"
"Coastal elk. They thrive in that area."
"These seemed almost tame."
"Maybe because tourists drive through there all the time." Slowly turning and turning the screwdriver, he considered her explanation.
"Maybe."
China saw that the fingers of his right hand were covered with a film of dry mud. He said,
"I can smell the musk of them now, the texture of their eyes, hear the greenness of the fern swaying around them, and it's a cold, dark oil in my blood."
No reply was possible, and she didn't try to make one. Vess lowered his gaze from China's eyes to the turning point of the screwdriver, and then to his shoes. He looked over his shoulder and saw the mud on the floor.
"This won't do," he said.
He put the screwdriver on a nearby counter. He took off his shoes and carried them into the laundry room, where he left them to be cleaned later. He returned in his stocking feet and, using paper towels and a bottle of Windex, cleaned every crumb of mud from the tiles. In the living room, he used a vacuum cleaner to sweep the mud out of the carpet. These domestic chores occupied him for almost 15 minutes, and by the time he finished, he was no longer in the mood that had possessed him when he'd entered the kitchen. Housework seemed to scrub away his blues.
"I'm going to go upstairs and sleep now," he said. "You'll be quiet and not rattle your chains much."
She said nothing.
"You'll be quiet, or I'll come down and shove 5 feet of the chain up your ass."
She nodded.
"Good girl."
He left the room. The difference between Vess's usual demeanor and his recent mood no longer eluded China. For a few minutes he had lacked his usual self-confidence. Now he had it back.
"Mr. Vesso sleeps in the nude to facilitate his dreams. In Slumberland, all the people whom he encounters are naked, whether they are being torn asunder beneath him in glorious wetness, or are running in a pack with him through high-shadowed places and down into moonlight. There is a heat in his dreams that not only makes clothes superfluous, but burns from him the very concept of clothes. So going naked is more natural in the dream world than in the real one." He never suffers from nightmares. This is because in his daily life he confronts the sources of his tensions and deals with them. He is never dragged down by guilt. He is not judgmental of others and is never affected by what they think of him. He knows that if something he wishes to do feels right, then it is right. He always looks out for number one because to be a successful human being, he must first like himself. Consequently, he always goes to his bed with a clear mind and an untroubled heart. Now, within seconds of resting his head on his pillow, Mr. Vess is asleep. From time to time, his legs cycle beneath the covers as if he is chasing something. Once in his sleep, he says, "Father," almost reverentially, and the word hangs like a bubble on the air. Which is odd, because when Edgler Vess was 9 years old, he burned his father to death. Chains rattling, China leaned down and picked up the spare cushion from the floor beside her. She put it on the table, slumped forward, and rested her head on it. According to the kitchen clock, it was 11:45. She had been awake well over 24 hours, except when she had dozed in the motorhome and when she had sat here unconscious after Vess had clubbed her. Although exhausted and numb with despair, she did not expect to be able to sleep, but she hoped that by keeping her eyes closed and letting her thoughts drift to more pleasant times, she might be able to take her mind off her mild but gradually increasing urge to pee and off the pain in her neck and trigger finger. She was walking in a wind full of torn red blossoms, curiously unafraid of the darkness and of the lightning that sometimes split it, when she was awakened not by thunder, but by the sound of scissors clipping through paper. She lifted her head from the pillow and sat up straight. The fluorescent light stung her eyes. Edgler Vess was standing at the sink, cutting open a large bag of potato chips. He said,
"Ah, you're awake, you sleepyhead."
China looked at the clock. 5:20. He said,
"I thought it might take a brass band to bring you around."
She had been asleep almost 5 hours. Her eyes were grainy, her mouth was sour. She could smell her body odor, and she felt greasy. She had not wet herself in her sleep, and she was briefly lifted by an absurd sense of triumph that she had not yet been reduced to that lower level of humiliation. Then she realized how pathetic she was, priding herself on her continence, and her internal grayness darkened by a degree or two. Vess was wearing black boots, khaki slacks, a black belt, and a white T-shirt. His arms were muscular, enormous. She would never be able to struggle successfully against those arms. He brought a plate to the table. He had made a sandwich for her, ham and cheese with mustard. A ruffle of lettuce showed at the edge of the bread. He had placed 2 dill pickle spears beside the sandwich. As Vess put the bag of potato chips on the table, China said,
"I don't want it."
"You have to eat," he said.
She looked out the window at the deep yard in late afternoon light.
"If you don't eat," he said, "I'll eventually have to force feed you."
He picked up the bottle of aspirin and shook it to get her attention.
"Tasty."
"I didn't take any," she said.
"Ah, then you're learning to enjoy your pain."
He seemed to win either way. He took away the aspirin and returned with a glass of water. Smiling, he said,
"You've got to keep those kidneys functioning, or they'll atrophy."
As Vess cleaned the counter where he'd made the sandwich, China said, "Were you abused as a child?" And hated herself for asking the question, for still trying to understand. Vess laughed and shook his head.
"This isn't a textbook, China. This is real life."
"Were you?"
"No. My father was a Chicago accountant. My mom sold women's wear at a department store. They loved me. Bought me too many toys, more than I could use, especially since I preferred playing with other things."
"Animals," she said.
"That's right."
"And before animals, insects were very little things like goldfish or turtles."
"Is that in your textbooks?"
"It's the earliest and worst sign, torturing animals." He shrugged.
"It was fun, watching the stupid thing crawl on fire inside its shell. Really, China, you have to learn to get beyond these petty value judgments."
She closed her eyes, hoping he would go to work.
Anyway, my folks loved me, all caught up in that delusion. When I was 9, I set a fire, lighter fluid in their bed while they were sleeping, then a cigarette. My God. There you go again.
Why?
He mocked. Why not? Jesus. Want the second best answer?
Yes, she said.
Then look at me when I talk to you.
She opened her eyes. His gaze cleaved her.
I set them on fire because I thought maybe they were beginning to catch on.
To what?
To the fact that I was something special.
They caught you with the turtle, she guessed.
No, a neighbor's kitten. We lived in a nice suburb. There were so many pets in the neighborhood. Anyway, when they caught me, there was talk of doctors. Even at 9, I knew I couldn't allow that. Doctors might be harder to fool. So we had a little fire.
And nothing was done to you?
Finished with his cleaning, he sat down at the table.
No one suspected. Dad was smoking in bed, the fireman said. It happens all the time. The whole house went. I barely got out alive, and Mommy was screaming, and I couldn't get to her, couldn't help my Mommy, and I was so scared.
He winked at her.
After that, I went to live with my grandma. She was an annoying old biddy, full of rules, regulations, standards of conduct, manners, and courtesies I had to learn. But she couldn't keep a clean house. Her bathroom was just disgusting. She led me into my second and last mistake. I killed her while she was standing in the kitchen, just like this, preparing dinner. It was an impulsive thing, a knife twice in each kidney.
How old?
Slyly playing with her, he said.
Grandma or me?
You.
11. Too young to be put on trial. Too young for anyone to really believe that I knew what I was doing.
They had to do something to you.
14 months in a caring facility. Lots of therapy, lots of counseling, lots and lots of attention and hugs. Because you see, I must have offed poor Grandma because of my unexpressed grief over the accidental death of my parents in that awful, awful fire. One day I realized what they were trying to tell me, and I just broke down and cried and cried. Oh, China, how I cried and wallowed in remorse for poor Grandma. The therapists and social workers were so appreciative of the wallowing.
Where did you go from the facility?
I was adopted.
Speechless, she stared at him.
I know what you're thinking, he said. Not many 12-year-old orphans get adopted. People are usually looking for infants to mold in their own image. But I was such a beautiful boy, China, an almost ethereally beautiful boy. Can you believe that?
Yes.
People want beautiful children with nice smiles. I was sweet-tempered and charming. By then I'd learned to hide better among all you hypocrites. I'd never again be caught with a bloody kitten or a dead grandmother.
But who would adopt you after what you did?
What I did was expunged from my record, of course. I was just the littlest boy, after all. China, you wouldn't expect my whole life to be ruined just because of one mistake. Psychiatrists and social workers were the grease in my wheels, and I will always be beholden to them for their sweet, earnest desire to believe.
Your adoptive parents didn't know?
They knew that I'd been traumatized by the death of my parents in a fire, that the trauma had led to counseling, and that I needed to be watched for signs of depression. They wanted so badly to make my life better, to prevent depression from ever touching me again.
What happened to them?
We lived there in Chicago 2 years, and then we moved here to Oregon. I let them live for quite a while, and I let them pretend to love me. Why not? They enjoyed their delusions so much. But then after I graduated from college, I was 20 years old and needed more money than I had, so there had to be another dreadful accident, another fire in the night. But it was 11 long years since the fire that took my real mom and dad and half a continent away. No social workers had seen me in years, and there were no files about my horrible mistake with Grandma, so no connections were ever made.
They sat in silence.
After a while, he tapped the plate in front of her.
"Eat, eat," he cajoled. I'll be eating at a diner myself. Sorry I can't keep you company.
I believe you, she said.
What?
That you were never abused. Though that runs against everything you've been taught. Good girl, China. You know the truth when you hear it. Maybe there's hope for you yet.
There's no understanding you, she said, though she was talking more to herself than to him.
Of course there is. I'm just in touch with my reptilian nature, China. It's in all of us. We all evolved from that slimy-legged fish that first crawled out of the sea. The reptile consciousness, it's still in all of us, but most of you struggle so hard to hide it from yourselves, to convince yourselves that you're something cleaner and better than what you really are. The irony is, if you just for once acknowledged your reptile nature, you'd find the freedom and the happiness that you're all so frantic to achieve and never do.
He tapped the plate again, and then the glass of water. He got up and tucked his chair under the table.
That conversation wasn't quite as you expected, was it, China?
No.
You were expecting me to equivocate, to whine on about being a victim, to indulge in elaborately structured self-delusions, to spit up some tale of warping incest. You wanted to believe your clever probing might expose a secret religious fanaticism, bring revelations that I hear godly voices in my head. You didn't expect it to be this straightforward, this honest.
He went to the door between the kitchen and the living room and then turned to look at her.
I'm not unique, China. The world is filled with the likes of me. Most are just less free. You know where I think a lot of my type wind up?
In spite of herself, she asked. Where?
In politics. Imagine having the power to start wars, China. How gratifying that would be. Of course, in public life, one would generally have to forego the pleasure of getting right down in the wet of it, hands dirty with all the wonderful fluids. One would have to be satisfied with the thrill of sending thousands to their deaths, remote destruction. But I believe I could adapt to that. And there would always be photos from the war zone, reports all as graphic as one requested, and never a danger of apprehension. More amazing, they build monuments to you. You can bomb a small country into oblivion, and dinners are given in your honor. You can kill 34 children in a religious community, crush them with tanks, burn them alive, claim they were dangerous cultists, then sit back to the sound of applause. Such power. Intensity.
He glanced at the clock. A few minutes past 5. He said, I'll finish dressing and be gone back as soon after midnight as I can be. He shook his head as if saddened by the sight of her.
Untouched and alive. What kind of existence is that, China? Not one worth having. Get in touch with your reptile consciousness. Embrace the cold and the dark. That's what we are.
He left her in chains as twilight entered the world and the light withdrew.
Mr. Vest steps onto the porch, locks the front door, and then whistles for the dogs. The day is growing cooler as it wanes and the air is bracing. He zips up his jacket. From different points of the compass, the four Dobermans sprint out of the twilight and race to the porch. As they scamper to Vess and jostle one another to be the closest to him, their big paws thump on the boards in a fandango of canine delight. He kneels among them, generously doling out affection once more. Oddly like people, these Dobermans appear to be unable to detect the insincerity of Mr. Vess's love. They are only tools to him, not treasured pets, and the attention he gives them is like the 3-in-1 oil with which he occasionally lubricates his power drill, handheld belt sander, and chainsaw. In the movies, it is always a dog that senses the werewolf potential in the moon-fearing man and greets him with a growl, always a dog that shies away from the character who is secretly harboring the alien parasite in his body. But movies are not life. The dogs are no doubt deceiving him just as he deceives them. Their love is nothing but respect or sublimated fear of him. He stands and the dogs look up expectantly. Earlier they had been summoned from their kennel by the buzzer. Therefore they are now merely on an apprehend and detain status. Nietzsche, he says. As one, the four Dobermans twitch and then become rigid. Their ears first prick at the command word but then flatten. Their black eyes shine in the dusk. Abruptly they depart the porch, scattering across the property, having been elevated to attack status. Putting on his hat, Mr. Vess walks toward the barn where he keeps his car. He leaves the motorhome parked beside the house. Later, to minimize the distance that the two bodies will have to be carried, he will bring the vehicle along the lane closer to the meadow of unmarked graves. As he walks, Mr. Vest draws slow, deep breaths and clears his mind, preparing himself for re-entry into the workaday world. He enjoys the charade of his second life, passing for one of the repressed and deluded who, in uncountable multitudes, rule the earth with lies, who pass their lives in denial, anxiety, and hypocrisy. He is like a fox in a pen of mentally deficient chickens that are unable to distinguish between a predator and one of their own. And this is a fine game for a fox with a sense of humor. Every day, all day long, Vess weighs other people with his eyes, furtively tests their firmness with a friendly touch, breathes the enticing scents of their flesh, selecting among them as if choosing packaged poultry at a market. He does not often kill those whom he meets in his public persona, only if he is absolutely certain that he can get away with it, and if the particular chicken promises to be tasty. If China Shepherd hadn't disturbed his usual routine, Vess would have spent more time reacclimating himself to his role as an ordinary guy. He might have watched a game show on television, read a couple of chapters in a romance novel by Robert James Waller, and skimmed an issue of People to remind himself of those things that the desperate ruck of humanity uses to anesthetize itself against the awareness of its true animal nature and the inevitability of death. He might have stood before a mirror for a while, practicing his smile, studying his eyes. Nevertheless, by the time that he reaches the silvered cedar barn, he is confident that he will slide back into his second life without a ripple, and that all those who look into his pond will be comforted to see their own faces reflected. Most people have expended so much effort and time in the denial of their predatory nature that they cannot easily recognize it in others. He opens the man-sized door beside the larger roll-up, pauses, and glances toward the back of the house. He left the woman in the dark, so he can't even vaguely discern her form through the distant window. The sunless, somber twilight is still bright enough, however, for Ms. Shepherd, the eminent psychologist, to have seen him as he walked to the barn. She could be watching now. Mr. Vess wonders what she thinks of him in this surprising new guise. She must be shocked. More illusions shattered. Seeing him on his way to his second life, realizing that indeed he passes for a stand-up citizen, she must be plunged into a despair deeper than any she has yet known. He has such a way with women.